Close, who's counsel for the defendant, Paul Rudzinski. Counsel.
May it please the court and counsel, the petitioner, Paul Rudzinski, appears personally before this court and through his lawyers as the petitioner in this case. My name is Craig Mastantuno, and my co-counsel is Maureen Fitzgerald. The petitioner respectfully asks this court to reverse the Court of Appeals ruling in this case and to reaffirm the longstanding requirement that a warrantless search or seizure be based upon a police officer's own reasonable suspicion. The lower ruling would allow police officers to substitute the opinion of unknown tipsters for their own judgment. And the state wants this court to affirm that ruling and to extend police authority to restrict a person's liberty at the expense of appropriate police monitoring and investigation of the public while they drive. The state urges a ruling from this court that the police may take a report of bad driving from an unidentified tipster and to use that report to justify a warrantless seizure of a driver. Now, the lower court's ruling in this case is unsupported by precedent and would lead to large numbers of unconstitutional stops, in the opinion of the petitioner. The record is clear that the tip in this case was from an unknown caller. To the extent that the facts that we can rely upon are restricted to the record in this case, we still don't know who this caller was. We don't know the name, age, address, gender, make of automobile, whether that caller had passengers or impairments to visual observation or any other types of observations, or a motive for, or what the motive was for calling the police.
The caller did stop at the side of the road when the police stopped Mr. Rudzinski, and the supervisor did talk with this caller, right?
That is the reference that's on the record, Chief, is that the officer who testified said, well, my supervisor had a chance to talk with the caller later. That's the only record we have about that. And I would posit that the reliability of the information provided by that caller was still not tested at the time the seizure was made.
But one of the factors, counsel, seems to me as we're seeing this law develop, is the one pointed to by Justice Kennedy, and that is whether or not the anonymous informant placed his or her anonymity at risk. And unlike the former case, and you were in the court to hear that, at least here, unquestionably, the informant placed his anonymity at risk. He stayed with the vehicle, then stopped with the car, and if in fact the police had chosen to inquire further about him, he would have had to presumably give his name and other identifiable information. Doesn't that place this in the category, start to move, at least move this more towards those category of cases that we would call the reliable informant cases?
It certainly moves us towards a case where anonymity is not as great as somebody that we don't know anything about or how to find that person later. But that point conceded, Justice, I would like to say that the concurring opinion in JL and the example cited does not really address, in a traffic case, the mistaken caller. Okay, I think it's the argument would be, well, if you place your own anonymity at risk, you will suffer repercussions later if you report falsely to the police. And that does not address the mistaken caller. People can easily be mistaken about driving.
Counsel, you just made reference again to another string that I want you to follow.
Yes, sir.
And I, please, if you're going to answer it later, then just ignore my question. You referred to this as a traffic arrest. Well, there are traffic arrests with a small T and traffic arrests with a capital T. This is not a caller saying, I've seen a guy speeding, or a guy's driving too slow, or he's eating traffic. This is a guy saying, look, we've probably got a drunken driver on our hands. And with a 3,000-pound vehicle or something, that's tantamount, at least it seems to me, is saying, we've got a guy operating a very dangerous weapon.
Well, I'd like to answer that question and then move on to what I was saying Justice.
I guess what I'm asking is, does that place it more in an emergency situation than the call saying, we've got a guy going 5 miles an hour?
Sure, I think that's a reasonable inquiry, Justice, and I think I would answer the question in this way. I think that it's tempting to presume good reliability and good basis of knowledge because the caller was on the scene and said these things, that there was somebody who was varying speeds, that there was somebody who was tailgating, and that there was somebody who was weaving within his own lane. That's what the dispatch advised to the officer. Not that there was somebody who was intoxicated, but this certainly could be a suspicion of that. But what really did that caller say? There were still opinions that were conclusory. In other words, why we would ask an officer at a citation case who said this driver was speeding, why was that driver speeding? Did you radar that vehicle? Did you pace that vehicle? What was the posted speed limit? We would ask of an officer at a citation case for tailgating, how closely was he or she following the vehicle in front of it? Was it within a car length or a half of car length, and for how long? We would ask in weaving, well, did this vehicle, as we often see in cases, touch the center line two times and then go back and touch the sideline? Now, I'm not saying that callers should be held to that standard when they call in, because we want to encourage reports by callers to the police of what they think may be suspicious activity. But I would say that we would hold an officer to these questions about a seizure or a citation, and we have to hold information from citizens to the same standard, especially since citizens have no training or experience in traffic law. And while we may not have a case where dispatch should say, well, how close or did you pace the vehicle, obviously that would be unreasonable to require. That brings us back to the key ingredient in this constitutional analysis, which is some corroboration by the police officer of some suspicious illegal activity or bad driving or something that would indicate that an intoxicated driving is occurring. And that is not the case on the record that we have here. We have an officer who immediately spotted the vehicles pass by him, immediately pulled the petitioner's vehicle over upon seeing that vehicle, and testified that he saw no bad driving or nothing that would indicate intoxicated driving or grave danger to the community, something requiring immediate action.
Well, Coles, I might buy your argument if the report had been, look, I'm on the Beltline and a car just passed me going 75 miles an hour and gives a complete description, and there happens to be a cop right there, and a cop gets behind him, but he's observing, at that point, he's observing the speed limit, and there's, you know, nothing in danger. But here we've got a call saying something more than speeding. We've got a caller saying, in essence, there's a drunken driver on the road and he's jeopardizing a lot of lives.
We still, in the first example, and I believe that's an example I cited in my brief also, Justice, which was the speeding caller. Caller says, I'm on I-94 in a blue car, the truck in front of me is speeding. Police go right there. The state wants a ruling that would allow a stop. We're still talking about traffic violations. And stopping somebody for speeding can render further evidence that someone was speeding. What's the first question we're always asked when we're pulled over for speeding? Do you know how fast you were going? Oftentimes we say, well, officer, I know I was speeding, but I have to go to the bank before it closes, or I have to get to the Supreme Court to argue an oral argument. And so that would render evidence from the officer's further investigation. And in this case, I think that we are tempted to say, well, possible intoxicated driving cases are different. And I would say no. I would say that, and we know that, a seizure of a vehicle for suspected intoxicated driving still must be based on a reasonable suspicion, which is based on specific and articulable facts, which we don't have in this case. We would hold an officer who pulls over a vehicle for possible intoxicated driving to that standard, and we should also hold information from citizens to the same standard.
But in this case, unlike a speeding case, when the officer gets behind him, if he's not speeding, all the officer has for evidence, and it's not evidence, is the call. The officer's not going to be able to ticket him based upon his own observations, whether he stops him or not. But in a drunken driving case, if there's a reasonable suspicion raised, that officer can stop, can freeze the situation, and make a determination himself if, in fact, the driver was intoxicated. It strikes me as being two very, very different cases.
I think it's true that the officer can do that, and I think that we can't think about a police-citizen encounter as a single moment. In this case, it was a single moment because the officer saw the vehicle, got behind it, stopped it immediately. But there was nothing in this case, in this record, to support a conclusion that there was an immediate grave and danger, an imminent and grave danger. This was a type of bad driving, not driving that necessarily endangered the public safety. And the officer's own observations were of normal and safe driving. He testified to that at the hearing. This was not a report of a bomb or even of a crime that would imply a criminal offense that would imply danger. It was a report of bad driving, which for a number of reasons, the officer had options available to him prior to that seizure.
What were the options?
The options could have been, well, first we know that the officer was on the scene, Chief, and monitoring, and had things available. We want officers to monitor traffic safety, but not at the cost of people's rights to be...
How long does he have to follow it?
Long enough until he sees weaving within the lone lane, or possible tailgating, or possible varying of speeds. The officer could have also run the plates on the vehicle, which were on this vehicle, talk to the tipster. The officer can act only when his hunch, or the citizen's hunch, ripens into a reasonable suspicion. And the standard is the same for conclusions based on tips. What I wanted to say with regard to the caller making himself or herself, we don't know who this caller was, available by being on the scene and apparently not trying to conceal where he or she could be found, is that this does not address the mistaken caller. And driving is something that is so commonplace and vulnerable to such subjective opinions that we all have about different ways we drive, that this is a particularly good case where somebody might be mistaken. People lack experience and training that police officers have to monitor traffic safety. They base their opinions upon their own driving. For example, the proverbial putt-putt driver who thinks that everybody who drives the speed limit or 5 miles above the speed limit is a raging speedster. An opinion about another's driving is more likely to be mistaken than a report about a specific crime. And this report, in this case, would not have been the basis for a ticket without further information why this was cited. Now, these callers would not face repercussions or untoward circumstances, as the lower court's opinion in this case uses that phrase. Would there have been an obstructing ticket if the petitioner's the stop of the petitioner's vehicle rendered no evidence of intoxicated driving? And then the caller was indeed found, would they have cited the caller for obstructing? No, because the key here is still corroboration. We can't even corroborate that the tipster was lying or was gravely mistaken, rising to some type of criminal negligence, because the police have corroborated nothing in this case except the petitioner's vehicle driving down the street apparently safely, readily observable information, as JL uses that term. And so I don't think it's reasonable to impute certainty upon the officer that the caller would even be available later, because we don't know the extent that caller was available later, or that caller would face untoward circumstances or repercussions. I also think that we want to encourage a policy of people reporting suspicious or criminal or activity that they're worried about to the police. And so the police do not want to pursue every false or wrong or mistaken report against that tipster and say, well, you will now face repercussions because you were wrong. It's in the interest of police to encourage reports from people. About that also, I would say, getting to the information that was provided to the police, conclusory opinion about speeding, conclusory opinion about tailgating, conclusory opinion about weaving within the own lane. We are in society our brother's keepers, but some of us are better keepers than others. And the police, with their training and experience, especially in traffic monitoring, are presumably the best keepers. And so we would not want this officer to substitute the tipster's opinion for his own judgment. We would want this officer to do, up until a point in this case, exactly what he did: make himself available, monitor on the scene what was occurring, and detect and investigate possible criminal or illegal activity or traffic violations.
So you're basically asking for a bright line rule that every citizen call must be subjected to an independent investigation observation by the dispatched officer before the stop can be justified?
Justice, I think to a certain extent, I think that we do have a bright line rule in the sense that anonymous tips and tips from unknown callers have always been viewed with great skepticism and scrutiny by reviewing courts. Now, those tips can sometimes provide the basis for a conclusion that reasonable suspicion existed. Alabama versus White has really outlined the only example thus far that has precedential import for this court, and that's where a tipster is deemed to have inside information because of an accurate prediction of future activity. Thus far, we have no other rule, so I don't think I'm encouraging a bright line rule that's an extension of the law. I think that the state is asking this court to carve out a new exception with regard to callers who may place their own anonymity at risk and suffer repercussions later, and so, I think that would be erroneous.
So your position is that Fourth Amendment law as it currently stands requires that independent observation, investigation, and corroboration by the officer before the stop can be justified?
When we have an unknown caller and a tip that does not provide an accurate prediction of future activity, there's some corroboration required.
I think Justice Pavlich certainly adequately explored this, but you're saying that it makes no difference whether it was a tip before and then they determined the identity of the person afterward. You're saying in this case they did not.
We know that they did not in this case.
Yeah. Now, I was just looking at the record, and at least on page 18, and maybe this is a misreading, but I just wanted to indicate that, and I believe this was defense counsel before, a Mr. Burchett, said the fact that Mr. Radzinski could be proven guilty by a citizen we now know the identity of does not make the stop, you know, does not make the stop legal. So I'm assuming, I'm from that statement, there's an assumption that they did find out the identity of this person later on.
With all the respect that Mr. Burchett is due, Your Honor, and I did not conduct that hearing, I think that was an erroneous remark made in argument, because the testimony that's on the record in this case contains no reference to the caller's name or even a reference that my supervisor spoke with him later or her later and found out that they were a person that they could identify later. We don't have that.
Well, record. Because the judge also indicated that in his opinion that they knew the identity of the driver at this time. I mean, that was the judge's, the judge also stated that.
That was Judge Kramer's remark, and I afford him great respect also, and I think that was an erroneous remark during argument regarding the case. And it's not supported in the record.
They heard him on the telephone, but then somebody saw him, but they don't have at least they don't have in the record a
not
name, address, telephone number. So
yes.
There was a human being. It wasn't
I would not,
a computer recording.
I would not.
It was a human being.
Yes, I would not dispute that.
But they don't know who. At least the record doesn't show it, even though they saw him.
Right.
And he did not, or she did not testify.
That's correct, right? Your Honor. That's correct, Justice.
So after the stop, the police officers know the human being that reported it because they have seen him and have talked to him. They just haven't kept a record of it. So we know a citizen was there, did report it, and was kind enough and good enough to stay with it and see the police so that there was a potential for identification.
I would agree with that summation, Madam Chief Justice, and I would still say that the reasonableness of the official suspicion must be measured by what the officers knew before they conducted their search. If we have this person later, and I still think the record is sketchy, but if the police have this person later, it does not answer the question of what they knew before they conducted their search or seizure. And I don't think it's reasonable to assume that this caller, in any instance in a case like this, would be available later for questioning. Cars are inherently mobile, and we don't know if that caller would be stopped or if a supervisor, as apparently was the case in this record, would be available to stop later.
Well, let me see if I can summarize what I think I'm hearing. You agree that an anonymous tip, if it's predictive of future behavior, that's good enough for reliability?
It can be, yes.
Okay. It's not here, because there was no prediction of the future. Okay. Let's see about your second one. You agree that if there was personal observation by the police officer, that would have been good enough. So if the police officer saw weaving or tailgating and could so testify, that would have been good enough to pull him over.
Subject to the adversarial proceeding that he would be testifying in, yes, I agree, okay. Madam Chief Justice.
Let's look at a third. Suppose that the caller identified herself and gave the license number of a car she was driving, and the police knew that. Is that good enough?
I would say no.
Okay. You would say that knowing the identification of the citizen informant is not good enough to show reliability.
I would, and I'll take an opportunity to say why, but I have a feeling that you're not done with
okay.
the questions.
Well, no, I would say why. My own information from the cases would indicate, man, we're getting close to where you ought to trust this guy.
We are. However, I think that we're very, very tempted to go in a direction now of saying, well, if we know a name or where this person can be found, that's enough without knowing more. And we bypass still what is said about the alleged criminal activity. For instance, if I may cite an example, let's take the JL case. Let's assume that the fact scenario was that the caller in JL was across the street or near the bus stop, and the police, and transmits that information over the call. The police go to where that bus stop is, immediately sees JL without any prior encounter of this informant or attempt to talk to this informant prior to the seizure. Would the result in JL be different? I don't think so. Because the exact example that the concurring opinion in JL cites is, let's assume that a caller places his own anonymity at risk and cites an example of a motorist on the road who stops momentarily and describes briefly, face-to-face to the officer, the criminal activity that is occurring. The concurrence says, well, that might be different, but we don't have to address this case for this opinion. The face-to-face isn't magic, but face-to-face allows the officer to use his or her own training experience to assess credibility, assess reputation, ask follow-up questions. Why was this driver speeding? Why do you think that the person on the bus stop was carrying a gun? And then use his or her own training experience to make a determination as to whether or not there's specific and articulable facts to form a reasonable suspicion. The state says that there's not much difference between these cases and Sierra Hernandez, which involved a face-to-face encounter, but it's not so much that there was just a face-to-face encounter, it was what was said during that encounter. This was a Border Patrol officer who the caller or the person that he spoke to face-to-face said, that truck just loaded with weed, first of all, a specific criminal offense, down at the cane break. And the opinion goes on to say, the Border Patrol officer knew that the cane break was an area where people got drugs and transmitted drugs and a drug dealing activity occurred. So it's these things that happen during face-to-face encounters that can enable an officer to use his own training and experience, much like Officer McFadden in the Terry case, to then say, this is what I see or this is what I've heard, and now I deem it to be a suspicion that's reasonable and based on facts that I could articulate later in court.
Counsel, it seems to me that in this case there may be a degree of predictive behavior. That is, as I understand the facts, that when they first called in the officer heard the information that the driver and the defendant were westbound, the officer was eastbound. They started out at 51 in Grange. The officer got to the closest median and was advised that the subject vehicle was a black pickup truck. heading west, and he stops, and sure enough, pretty soon a black pickup truck passes him at the location that he was advised that a black pickup truck is coming down the road. Isn't that some predictive behavior?
Justice, I would say that that is information, all of that is information that was readily observable to anyone on the street, by anyone on the street at that time. It's not the type of predictive behavior that would impart upon an officer a conclusion, hey, this person has inside information. They know more than what they're telling me about a specific crime because they are an insider. This is something that would tell an officer, well, somebody else standing on 51st and Grange or driving down 60th and Grange could see. And that's the key. But
what about the added part that the officer apparently was advised that the driver behind the subject vehicle had told dispatch that the black pickup was weaving in its lane, varying in its speeds, both excessive and too slow, tailgating, and that it was heading westward in that direction. And sure enough, there it showed up. So that doesn't make any difference for predictive behavior under your argument.
Well, Justice, the only prediction out of what you just cited that was corroborated by the officer was heading east. There was no prediction that the vehicle would weave that was corroborated. There was no prediction that speeds would vary that was corroborated.
But there was a prediction that it was coming down the road, and that was corroborated.
I agree with that.
So there is some predictive behavior.
Some predictive behavior, but not in the assertion of its illegality or suspicious activity.
Sure. May I ask a question? I'm trying to get at whether the conduct of a caller was normal or not, or whether it was extraordinary. Drivers see many other vehicles, and they often see vehicles violating the motor vehicle laws. But this driver picked up the telephone in the automobile, called the police, and not only reported what he saw, actually followed the car. There's a certain intensity in that, it seems to me. Am I just wrong? Did you attach anything to... Or is this normal behavior? Does everybody do that?
I certainly would not disagree that there's a certain amount of intensity that's greater than a caller saying, I saw a guy speeding and I can't be found now. But I still don't think that imports upon the officer a conclusion that the motive for doing that was reasonable, that the person who's calling had no impairments in his or her own observations, especially lacking training and experience to make conclusions. And that's why I would assert that corroboration of something before this stop was made is still the key. And this is not a moment. This was the officer doing what we would expect an officer to do, follow and monitor. And I would say that this seizure occurred too soon. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you. Guess I would. I'll start with my factors that I didn't get through the last time. The first one is whether or not the tipster gives the name and address, telephone number, and I approach that from the point of view of whether or not the caller is willing to place their anonymity at risk, not whether they objectively do, but whether they're willing to, because I think if one is willing to, that lends some reliability to the tip. And in this case, since the caller pulled over at the scene, there was certainly evidence that the caller was willing to be identified. The next is a more objective thing. Is there a way for the police to identify the tipster even if they don't volunteer something? And that would be something like the 911 system. License plates in this kind of a situation have been used a number of times in many of the cases. The police officer takes down the license number of the tipster, or that the tipster gives the license number, or gives some other identifying information that allows the officer to say, this particular person is the one who made the call. this is one, the third one is one that it seems to me that the concurring opinion in JL places quite a bit of stock in, and that is whether or not there's any criminal or forfeiture type penalties associated with giving the information in obstruction. And that, I think, I would agree with counsel, that does appear to be lacking in this particular case, but certainly would be available in a 911 call or in the face-to-face report of criminal behavior. The predictive future behavior, such as in White or in Richardson, has certainly been recognized. I wonder, though, in looking at that, having inside information, it seems to me, bodes more in favor of manufactured tips against someone you have a grudge against than in something that's fairly clearly a citizen call. I mean, we're after all dealing with people who are, if not in the criminal milieu, are certainly very close to it, and you wonder, having inside information to get rid of a rival might be more likely with someone who has the kind of inside information that we saw in Richardson or White.
So if you were going to do a table similar to the one I did in Probable Cause and say, what are the factors that are most likely to justify reasonable suspicion, you would put the citizen informer ahead of the inside informant.
Yes. And I think, generally speaking, the cases recognize that, both our cases here and in other jurisdictions.
Even if it's been a reliable informant in the past.
Well, citizens are, I guess, at the top of the list. People who've been used in the past and have given accurate information in the past, that used to be the Aguilar-Spinelli kind of approach.
You don't think that's the top?
I don't think that's...
A citizen without a grudge.
Well, I think not. I would put the citizen higher because the citizen is motivated by a sense of civic duty.
Driver here who reported...
I'm sorry.
Like this driver here who
reported
some money he thought was dangerous on the road, whether it was a defective car or whether the driver was sick or whether the driver was drunk. It was defective driving. Dangerous driving potential.
Yes. And certainly this motorist wasn't going to get anything out of this other than perhaps the feeling of being safer on the road.
Does the potential for serious injury to others, I mean, this isn't a bomb that Justice Ginsburg refers to, but nevertheless, the car packed a good wallop. Does this potential for serious harm weigh in the balance at all?
I think it's a factor to be considered. And drunk driving is not...
So you'd say you need less in a case involving a drunk driving as opposed to, let's say, a minor guy driving 10 miles an hour in a 50 mile an hour zone?
Well, I don't know that you'd say that you'd need less, but it's one of these kinds of things where if the public is more at risk, then... The need for continuing investigation or continuing observation would be less. Some of the other kinds of things, like corroborating the direction of travel in this case, or the description of the vehicle, I would say that wouldn't necessarily be less.
And then, of course, you argue the first case. There, the potential for harm, immediate harm, the immediacy of the harm was not present in that case as it is here.
That's right.
Is that also a fact?
Yes, I think probably it is. An ongoing drug transaction, I would say, is not as immediate a problem in terms of the investigating officers as the driving while intoxicated. or somebody waving a gun around.
What does the legislature say? What are the penalties of buying drugs for resale or just buying drugs?
Well, if you look at it from a penalty point of view, the drug situation is greater.
Than the drug drive. That's what I'm
right.
told. Whether we think it's more or less dangerous, the legislature that makes the policy of the state thinks the drug transaction is more dangerous.
Yes, that's true. And when I say that, what I'm saying is I think the threat of an immediate injury
that's
to someone is less in a drug transaction than in a driving while intoxicated. And I don't mean to say that the crime committed is less serious, but certainly one could see, and certainly one could argue, I think, effectively, that the long-term problem with the drugs is much greater than the driving while intoxicated.
But in terms of the need to bring a situation to a halt, to freeze it, far more immediate in a drunken driving case than in a...
Yes, I would have to concede that. And that is, after all, one of the things that we are in a Terry kind of situation. I mean, I guess I don't like to hear adversarial kinds of language in terms of a Terry stop, because that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about an adversarial situation. We're talking about a situation where police officers, based on articulable and sometimes observable facts, has a need to freeze the situation and resolve ambiguity to determine whether or not there is any criminal activity going on.
So what do you mean it's not adversarial? Sounds adversarial to me. In the last case, they drew guns on the people.
I'm sorry?
I said, what do you mean it's not adversarial? The last case, the police drew guns on
those
people.
It's not adversarial in the sense that we're setting some sort of burden on what the articulable suspicions are, and we're subjecting the articulable suspicions to cross-examination, and what questions would we ask if this person was testifying. That to me takes it outside of the situation that we have, which is a police investigation. So, I mean, yes, in the sense of adversarial confrontation, it is, and even the stop in this case was to that extent.
You're saying the dispatcher doesn't have to get the same information as a police officer might give in his or her report.
Right.
Suppose there had been no. Suppose the caller had never stopped and talked with an officer, whatever that was. How would that affect your case?
Well, I think it would detract from it, certainly. But the fact that the caller is predicting, and to this extent I think it's true, that the direction of travel is to some extent predictive, and that the description of the vehicle is definite, and sure enough, that vehicle comes along in that direction of travel. The fact that the caller stayed in contact with the dispatcher during the travel, I think, adds to the reliability of the tip. And the fact that the caller identifies that the officer has pulled in behind the correct vehicle adds to the reliability of the tip. So those kinds of things, even without pulling over, I think lend credibility to the tip. But certainly once the motorist pulls over, I think that's really quite indicative that we're dealing here with a reliable source. And he may have been.
Isn't it sort of after the fact, though?
I'm sorry?
Isn't it sort of after the fact? I mean,
well, you know, this one's kind of tough because the officer says he activates his lights. Now, under Hadori D, the stop doesn't technically occur until the person in the truck submits to the display of force or indication to stop. And the officer says as he pulled over, he noticed that the that the car in front, which was identified as the caller, also pulled over. So it's pretty contemporaneous in this case. I would suspect that that's fairly unusual. But at least in this case, at the time that Mr. Rutsinski submitted to the officer's display, so did the motorist.
If the caller had not stopped and the caller had not followed the vehicle about whom he made the report, where would your case be then?
Because that's probably not enough without some observation there. Because then all we'd have is a call that asserts, although you will find cases that will say this is sufficient, a call reports a drunk driver at such and such a location and describes the vehicle, the officer gets to the location, the vehicle's there, and they will okay those stops. If you take that out of the context of drunk driving, it seems like that would be insufficient. If you substitute their drug dealing for driving while intoxicated on a lot of these cases, I think you'd get a different result, and I'm not sure what that means. But certainly, if the source of the tipster's knowledge is known, and if the tipster is fairly well identified, those kinds of cases are fairly common, and I think those are sound. So the ones, for instance, where the Burger King person calls and said, there was a drunk driver that just went through the drive-through, here's the description of the vehicle, here's the license plate, the officer goes to the Burger King and sees the car pulling out of the parking lot, I think those are fairly sound. We know the tipster worked there, can be located, so there's a certain amount of placing the anonymity at risk. We know the source of the information is personal observation. There was something observed. Maybe it's not articulated, but certainly the person did something that indicated to the observer that the driver was intoxicated, and there's a detailed description that identifies the car. And to the extent that it's predictive and I suppose this is a characterization about whether it's predictive or not, when the officer arrives on a particular scene, there the car that matches the description is there. So I think those are those cases that go off on those factors are sound. And I think as a matter of public policy, we're only talking about a Terry stop now, and we're not talking about probable cause to arrest. There isn't probable cause to arrest based on that, I don't think. But certainly, is there cause for further investigation? I think yes.
You're not equating... let me ask it this way. Are you suggesting that officers coming to a parking lot and finding a car there at rest is future predictive behavior?
No, but it is corroboration. It's not predictive
future
behavior.
Because future behavior means some movement, right. some future action.
That's right. And the direction of travel is about right on the line, it would seem to me. I mean, one could fairly say that it wasn't observable by the officer, and it was predictive in the sense that the person says this is the direction they're traveling. So I think that can fairly be characterized as predictable. Having a vehicle at a particular location to me is more corroborative than predictable. That's not to say it doesn't mean anything. As the Supreme Court pointed out, it is accurate in the extent that it identifies the suspect or the target of the tip. So it's worth something, but it's especially if we look at it from the case law point of view, the predictive behavior is worth more. And that's actually one of the factors, it seems to me, is whether or not there are observable details that are corroborated. Now, that's lower in the level of reliability, but it does lend something, because as the cases have said, some accuracy in some things infers accuracy in the rest. So,
but corroboration to you is not a requirement, to say, by the personal observation of the officer. I'm looking at the Slater case, which I think you cite from Kansas, right?
Yeah.
And I'll say it to you. Now I can ask you my question differently. What's your authority for all the things you cited?
I'm sorry, for the...
What's your authority for all these elements that you said?
Oh, okay. Well,
you cited at 11, 13, 22, and 23 of the brief, Slater.
Oh, Slater, yes. The address, name, address, and telephone numbers, Evans from Florida on page 7 of my brief was a name and address and location. Butler case one after that was the person who was identified by where they worked and identified himself as the manager. The Barrel case from North Dakota was another attendant at a gas station, but not identified by more than that. The means for police discovery, that comes from the concurrence of in JL, the anonymity aspect or the
what
traceability.
What about sufficiently corroborated the information? I mean, JL, the corroboration was 100%.
It was, the only corroboration in JL was the identification of the individual.
And that's the only corroboration here, the identification of the car.
That,
the car is going,
that's right.
That direction,
that's
right behind me. There's no question. That's fully corroborated.
That's right.
What was not corroborated in JL and is not corroborated here is the illegal activity, either the possession of the gun or the weaving here.
That's right, or the source of the information. Here it's pretty plain that the motorist is reporting from personal observation. So we know, now again, I mean, it's true that it may be wrong, it may be mistaken, but we know that the caller believes they've observed tailgating, weaving, and the varying of speeds, and knows that by seeing it. And that was what was absent in JL. And so I would say, if to make JL like this case, you would say that person and said he was standing on the street corner waving a gun around. Then I think. I'm not sure that's enough, but still, if we know that the person observed something that made them believe that the person had a gun in their possession, here we didn't have that at all in JL. So
we have predictive behavior. There are going to be several of them, and they're going to be on a particular bus stop. So that was well predicted, just like he's going west.
Well, it was predictive of location.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like the car.
Right. Right. But the difference in this case and JL, in my view, is that in this case, based not only on on the fact that the caller pulled over, but also on the running travel log of the direction of travel, that this was all from personal observation.
So your difference here is that this theoretically identifiable person, or at least you know who it was,
right,
not that you know the name and address, in that it's very dangerous. But I would think, frankly, I was surprised about the jail decision. I think gun possession is as dangerous as drunk driving.
Well,
hurt a lot of people very quickly with guns. Many people drive intoxicated, I'm told, and they don't get into an accident. They get safely home. I suppose people have guns and they don't hurt people, but that was pretty dangerous. You can call it a status offense, but it's a very dangerous offense.
And there were, at the time of the JL decisions, three of the circuits, federal circuits, which based reasoning exactly on that, that said, we believe that because of that danger that we are going to okay these kinds of tips. And in my view, that was one of the main things why the Supreme Court took that particular case. As it turns out, the Williams cert was pending at the same time.
So they don't like this inference from behavior that there's a necessary dangerousness.
I think they referred to it as a gun exception, which I think is the way the solicitor argued it in the
Supreme
Court.
Just like they did a drug exception. Now, and you want a drunk driving exception?
No. and I think that's
exception.
One of the things.
911 exception. You don't want to have any of these labeled because that's a dangerous.
I think we're really treading on thin ice when we start looking at it as exceptions and bright line rules. If we say that's something that can be considered, I think that we can get away with that if you want to put it that way, or it's something that's appropriate. But I think one of the things that the Supreme Court fears, and probably correctly, is that when you have a rule that's fairly bright line, an exception, if you will, there are a lot of good, solid, logical reasons to expand it. And that's, it seems to me, what they're trying to avoid. And I think, frankly, that's why they cite Richards in that gun exception part of the opinion, is because that's exactly the same thing they said in Richards, is that if we allow this kind of exception for no-knock for drugs, then why wouldn't it be logical to expand it to other dangerous situations also? And I think that's their fear. So I guess I really want to stay away from exceptions and bright lines. But on the other hand, I do think the severity or the danger to the public is something that is part of the totality of the circumstances. And I think that's why that language about the bomb is in the majority opinion. Is I don't think they want to foreclose the fact that is something that in appropriate circumstances a court should look at.
So they allow a bomb exception?
Well, I'm not sure they will, and I'd be surprised if they said it that way. But I think they have a willingness to say that if it's sufficiently dangerous to the general public, then we're going to be more inclined in the totality of the circumstances to find that there is a reasonable suspicion. I guess one of the other things that I would stress about these kinds of factors is that they're never an exclusive list. And one of the problems that I think we've seen in this area and in others is when you have these kinds of itemizations, like we had in Aguilar-Spinelli for a while, the courts start focusing on those to the exclusion of other things. And that was one of my major problems with the Court of Appeals opinion in the Williams case, is it seems to focus on this predictive behavior to the exclusion of anything else. And so I don't want to say that any one thing is always going to work, because as soon as you do, you find the case where that kind of thing isn't really as close as we thought it was. So certainly in this case, it seems to me that we have a citizen who's reporting on this ongoing behavior, reporting it from observable personal observation, is following along, is willing to subject themselves to identification, and this one seems to me to be a reliable tip, and the officer was justified in taking it as sufficiently reliable to make a stop and further investigate and determine whether or not this driver was in fact intoxicated. Could be that it would happen to someone who was not, and all that would happen is the officer would talk to the person, make their own determination, and send them on their way. But that seems to me exactly what Terry stops are for. So I think this one makes it.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. It'll be this one makes it test. Counsel, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Well, I guess in a sense, nor am I in favor of bright line rules and exceptions, in the sense that I'm not saying that any tip which is anonymous or unknown requires an accurate prediction of future activity. And I don't think we have that in this case, and I'll cite an example about that. But what I am saying is that each case must be assessed individually, and that the record in this case does not support a conclusion of some type of grave and immediate danger that would justify some type of extension of the law in intoxicated driving cases. It was a tip of bad driving, and the officer's own observations were of normal, safe driving. Firearm possession is more dangerous in an immediate sense than intoxicated driving, potentially, and especially on the record in this case, where we have observed safe driving by the officer, who had the opportunity, and I want, as the state does, the officer to take this information, investigate further, and monitor the traffic laws and to see that they're being followed. The record in this case also did not place the officer's own safety in danger, where the officer testified he was following behind without incident. And that is different than an officer who may have to encounter somebody with a gun, as in JL, or potentially carrying a gun, as in drug cases. So the officer had steps here that he could take that would not place his own harm or his own safety in harm and the public safety in harm based on what he saw when he got there. I think with regard to the availability of this caller, it is a worse case for the state if this caller hadn't stopped later at the scene. And I think that an attempt now to look at hindsight and say, well, the caller did do that, is kind of a bootstrap way of saying, well, we can presume that in all cases now. And that would not protect the ordinary citizen engaged in ordinary activity, this hindsight bootstrap analysis. We have to judge this seizure at its moment. And in this case, it was a moment that was too soon. The state does say that, well, this was only a Terry stop, but this was only a reported violation of bad driving. And even in a Terry stop, the officer in Terry, Officer McFadden, was able to say, I thought somebody was casing a joint, so to speak, but here's why. Three men standing, one goes and looks, they look in the window, goes back, confers with the other two individuals. And that, in light of all of my training and my experience, not someone else's, and 24 years as a beat officer, I believe, in Baltimore, led him to conclude in that case that there was criminal activity afoot. With regard to the predictive information, I think that really what would make JL similar to this case is if the tip in JL was three men, three black men at a bus stop, a guy in plaid shirt walking east is carrying a gun. Different result in JL? I don't think so. That still is, as JL says, information that is only information that's readily observable regarding an accurate description of a suspect's observable location and appearance. It's, of course, reliable in a limited sense. It will help the police correctly identify the person whom the tipster means to accuse. And I think that's the same situation in this case, and that the result in J.L. and that quote would still hold water if it was black male in plaid shirt walking east carrying a gun. It's not predictive enough to deem the recipient of that tip with the knowledge that this tipster has inside information and really knows what's going to occur, such as Alabama versus White, where you have a lot of predictive information. A woman will leave. She will leave at this time. She will drive to this hotel. She'll be carrying drugs when she does so. I do believe that there is a presumption here that the informant was reliable because he made or she made extraordinary efforts to remain available. But that doesn't speak to whether or not that informant is motivated by some type of, well, this guy just cut me off, or whether this tipster is mistaken and has impairments to those observations, especially lacking training and experience that police have. And I think to a certain extent we have to be wary that the decision urged by the state could be a watershed of bad policy if people in police know that calling the police on another driver without any police corroboration will result in that driver being pulled over for suspicious activity and investigated by the police. Would it become a new form of road rage? Well, this guy cut me off. I'm going to tell the police he was weaving and driving drunk. I think that there is that concern there, and I'd ask this court to be wary of it and not extend the authority of police in these cases to substitute another's opinion for their own judgment. Thank you.
Counsel. Thank you, Mr. Messner.